Accession number 10415, reel 2.
George Chambers, reel 2. You were telling me about the voyage on the Duchess of Richmond.
It was really a very uneventful voyage. We had an escort of, I think, a couple of destroyers, and they were with us for some time, and then they suddenly disappeared one day, and we found out afterwards they'd gone, what was the name of the German?
Bismarck.
The Bismarck. And they'd gone to, when the Bismarck appeared out of the South Africa, out of Argentina or wherever it was, and they disappeared and left us to us, but we had no alarms, fortunately, and we arrived out in Port Said. We went up the Red Sea in the middle of, I suppose, I think it was about June, sometime June or July. And I can remember we were taken into the engine room of the Duchess, going up the Red Sea, where there was not a breath of air, and the heat was really terrific. How in the wide world anybody could stand that all day long? It was terrific. Of course, in those days the ships were coal fired. We arrived in Port Said and we went to a camp on the between Port Said and Cairo called Cassassine, I think it was. Yes, Cassassine, which was near the Sweetwater Canal, which was a misnomer if ever there was one, because it was the most appalling stench and dirt and filth all over the place. Our first introduction to Egypt was not a place we thought we'd enjoy very much. However, we weren't there very long when we were suddenly whipped off to Cyprus. This was just after Crete, as it was thought the next base of attack would be Cyprus. When we got there, we found there was only one, the 1st Battalion of the Sherwood Foresters, who'd been out in the east for some time, and they were the only people, apart from a few coastal battery guns. They were the only defences there were, and our battalion dug the defences of Nicosia Airport. And we were embarked at the bit on the top of the canal. What's that? It's not Port Said, it's the bottom, isn't it?
Doesn't matter.
Port Said. Anyway, we embarked there in a destroyer, which the Navy had suffered great casualties, of course, in Crete, and they didn't like being out without air cover. We had no air cover. We were shot across the Med to Cyprus at great speed. It was one of the latest mine-laying, I think it was HMS Latona, L-A-T-O-N-A, which a year or two later was sunk in Tobruk, I believe. But this was doing about well over 30 knots across, and we got into Famagusta, where on the quayside everything was thrown out as, and we embarked rather rapidly, and the ship turned round in no time and shot back again to Alexandria. But so they didn't certainly waste any time at all, but it was quite a thing to see this ship going across the Med at well over 30 knots. We then went on to this airfield, which was it was extremely hot. This, as I say, was in July, in the heat of the summer, and very, very hot indeed. And we dug ditches and command posts. And we stood to every morning and every night. We had half a day, we were given half a day off a week. But otherwise we were on full alert all the time. We used to go to...
You had a story of taking the RSM for a drink there. Could you
tell? Well, yes. I was a great friend of mine, Tommy Preacher, who was in the, I think it was D Company that time, and I took out the RSM to Nicosia one night for a drink. And we did them very well, so much so that the RSM was not seen for 2 days afterwards. So we were high praise from everyone because this RSM wasn't available for certain times, so the troops had a lot of peace. That there was a time in Cyprus, of course, drink was very expensive. Beer was 3 and 6 pence a bottle. Minute in these days, but that was a lot of money in those days. And brandy was 6 pence, brandy and soda was 6 pence, even in the honky-tonks.
Did that lead to any drunkenness?
There was, for the first couple of days, when the troops were first allowed out, this in mitigation, this would have been their first touches of civilization since we'd left England, apart from having 3 days in Durban. This was the first time that they'd been allowed any freedom at all and been able to get out. And of course they went out and found that for a shilling you could buy a bottle of brandy, and they were absolutely mortal, and we had a lot of problems for about 2 or 3 days, and then it just suddenly stopped. They realized they couldn't, they used to drink a bottle of brandy like drinking a bottle of beer, and of course the effect was disastrous. The guard room was absolutely jammed full of drunks every night when they came back.
Was there any trouble with the Cypriots?
No.
From Cyprus, you went to Iraq, northern Iraq. What do you remember about that time?
We left Cyprus. It was, we had one or two showers of rain in Cyprus, which it was incredible how the rains came down, and the ground became a mass of mud in no time, and the little wadis were roaring torrents, which had been perfectly dry before, and suddenly they were roaring torrents. So we left Cyprus and we went across to Haifa, and we were stationed outside of Haifa in a camp for a short time.
You were still adjutant at that time?
I was still adjutant, yes.
Did you have any problems with you'd exchanged equipment with an Indian division at that time, I understand. Did you have any in the emergency changeover? Did you notice any problems with that?
No, I don't, not so far as I can remember at all. I don't think there was any problem. This was the 10th Indian Division, I think.
And what happened then in the movement?
We were told we were going out to Iraq. One of the rumours going round at that particular time was that we were sent up to... We were sent up to join up with the Russians as the Germans were pushing down through the southern part of Russia. Whether this was true or not, we never found out. I should think it was highly unlikely. Because we were only two brigades, where there was the 69th and ourselves, 151. The 150 didn't go to Cyprus. They went up the desert straight away. So we didn't get back to three brigades in the division until we joined them all up in the desert. However, this time we went across by transport across Iraq, and we followed the pipeline, oil pipeline, which was from Kirkuk or Mosul across to, I think it was Haifa. And there was a track all the way from Palestine, the old Palestine, to Iraq, to Baghdad, roughly, where the track ran along the side of the pipeline. and various intervals along the pipeline there were pumping stations to pump, to keep the oil pumped through to the Mediterranean from Iraq. We were then the first real stop we had was at the RAF base Habaneer, which was a wonderful sight, as it was an oasis, and there was grass and trees and lawns, and a very highly, to us, highly civilized part after having been in the desert for so long. Then we went further into Iraq, further north, and went to a place called, we called Two Rivers, which was between Kirkuk and Mosul. Just a
did you have any
desert.
Problems with the local civilians at any time? Any sniping or abuse?
We
or?
Were stoned going through Baghdad.
Stoned?
Yes.
Why
by evil-looking Iraqis, who were the most evil-looking people you could imagine.
Why
in
were you
Baghdad.
Unpopular?
It was just after the we had had a battle with Iraqis just outside of Habaneer. And the Iraqis were just there.
There was sympathy for the rebels.
There was sympathy for the rebels, yes, and we had taken over and were running the place after that. So
what
we were
conditions
not
like at the Two Rivers camp then?
Bitterly cold.
How did you cope with that?
And we were living in tents. That's all we had. Well, one improvisation again, fortunately there was no shortage of petrol because we were on the pipeline and we're on the oil, near the oil wells, and with all the petrol were these in flimsy cans, which were very wasteful because they used to leak and the smell of oil was all over the petrol was all over the place. But we used to have burners and stoves made by there were quite a number of ingenious stoves, heaters, etc., made by the battalion ROC armourer and other people with bright ideas, which fortunately didn't blow up, burn anything down, but there were flames all over the place, and at least it brought us some warmth. But in the tents, where there was no warmth at all, in your sleeping tent, because every morning when you woke up, your toothbrush and shaving brush were frozen, and they had to be dipped in hot water, which you were lucky if you got it hot, which was brought over from the kitchen to wash in, but tremendously cold. In fact, one saw when you were going out, bodies lying around, Iraqis who were shepherds and various stages, who were frozen to death, who had just died out, as they never had any thick clothing or anything to keep them warm. They just died as they were. The place was littered with dead sheep and goats, all frozen to death, and some Iraqis as well.
From there, I believe, after the winter, you were called back to Egypt. What do you remember of the desert campaign that followed and the Gazala breakout?
Well, fortunately, we didn't stay there very long. We were then back again, back into the desert again. We came back to Palestine, then up through Egypt, up to the Gazala line. And we were then held, we were dug the defences in there. And
were you still adjutant? Or?
I was still adjutant then. And we took our positions in the box. The defences were boxes, called boxes. And where patrols went out to the in front to find out where the position of the Germans were at that time. And these patrols used to go out. They were called, the bigger ones were called jock calls, which went out with carriers, field gunners.
Did you ever go with one?
No, I didn't. I remained back with the battalion headquarters. We lived there, and we had a ration of half a gallon of water a day, which was for cooking, drinking, and washing. And we had a wonderful system of filtering the water through stones, which you found in the desert, and to try and keep it, because you normally kept the same washing water for about a week until the smell got a bit high. But he used to try and filter it and get the dirt out of it, but he had to use the same water over and over again, because there was half a gallon in that heat is not very much to last a day. This was the only drink you on hand.
Did you suffer from thirst?
Well, you've suffered from being... Oh, yes, I suppose you did to a certain extent, but it was bearable on that.
Any other aspects of desert warfare conditions you can remember?
There was always the problem of flies and dust, and the heat, of course. Occasionally one got an issue of cans of beer, but they were not very good because they got so hot, and because they used to, when you broke the tin, it shot up in the air. It was so fizzy, you wasted it all. You used to have to put it in your underneath the truck overnight, and you could drink it first thing in the morning because it was cold then. One thing about the desert was, at least at night time, it was cool. There was a big difference in the temperature. The temperature might be 90, say, during the day, or even higher, and then it would drop to about 60 during the night. Well, this was a very big difference, and 60 degrees at that, with a 90 degree period during the day, 60 degrees the night was cold. You always had to have two blankets on to sleep, so that you were not enervated by the heat. At night time, at least you could sleep in the cool, which made life bearable to that extent.
What do you remember of the operations, the breakout and the fallback to Mersa Matru? Anything come to mind?
One other thing, it was chaotic France had been in 40. It was very wild, very chaotic. Again, you didn't know who, and you had little idea as to where people were, and people would get lost because there were no such things as signs or roads. There may have been tracks, but you never knew where the tracks went to. You had to go on bearings and readings of the sun, which was not always very easy.
You would be with the headquarters company. Did you meet much opposition to your section of the 8th as you came through the bridgehead, or whatever you call it?
No, we didn't. We were fortunate enough. We seemed to be able to... We got through without any great troubles. Occasionally we ran into some columns, and there was a bit of short bursts of fighting, but one disappeared, and you got away from it, and you were lucky. You got away. If you didn't, you were captured.
What happened next then that you remember?
Well, we got back to the Ghazala line.
From the Ghazala line?
To the Alamein line, which what became the Alamein line. At that time, it was still rumoured that you couldn't see Cairo for smoke because of GHQ were burning all their documents as they were moving out to Palestine. This didn't help morale. By this time, the army commander changed and Monty had arrived. And the first thing he did was to call all the CEOs to a conference. This, of course, I think started off the rumour where he said, I am now going to speak. Anybody who wishes to cough will cough now, and therefore there will be no further coughing after that. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. My CEO, Colonel Lidwell, then went to this conference and came back full of enthusiasm because Monty had presented his plan, a future campaign, and there was to be no further going backwards. We stayed where we were, and we did not move from that. We stayed and fought. There was no going further going back. This had caused a tremendous impression, and for the after months of going backwards, we now had firm directions and firm leadership, and there was no wasting of assets by small attacks and small columns. There would be further equipment was guaranteed, and was shortly arrival, new equipment, new tanks, new anti-tank guns, and the whole situation was to be changed. This of course happened, and eventually Rommel attacked, but for the first time was beaten back. This was a tremendous feather in our caps, and this again improved morale very much. We were in the southern end of the line when the original battle started, and we stayed down in the southern area for about a week or so, and then we were switched up to the northern part, where we did the final attack through and breakthrough, and we had the 152 of the Highland Division, Brigade of the Highland Division on our right, and the New Zealand Brigade on our left. this eventually, the battle was joined, and we gradually moved forward in bursts, following the barrages. There were still tremendous artillery barrages, and we followed these. We came across an 88 millimeter gun, we could see in the distance. Of course, they were very huge, they were very big guns, and it wasn't dug in, and this gun was knocking out our tanks rapidly. They were then on, the guns came on under an intense barrage from our own artillery and within range from our own machine gunners, but they still continued firing. I was told by somebody who said afterwards they'd visited the area, and the crew were all dead around this gun. They were very brave men who continued firing to the last, and they did an awful lot of damage. Shortly after this, I was hit by a piece of shrapnel in my arm. Unfortunately, it wasn't a very big wound, but I was evacuated and eventually finished up in Cairo. And then I was evacuated to Jerusalem, the Kaiser's summer palace, where I went down with jaundice, which was far worse than my wound, and I felt awful for a long time afterwards. It was a great, it caused a tremendous amount of casualties on both, fortunately on both sides. The Germans, Italians and ourselves all went down with this. A lot went down. In fact, I think there were more casualties that were jaundiced than in the battle itself. However, I did eventually get myself sorted out and recovered, and managed to get myself, after a visitation to GHQ, got myself posted back to the battalion, who were then away up the desert.
That was important to you, to get back to your own battalion, was it?
Oh yes, the great thing was you had to know somebody in GHQ who you went to see, who was in charge of the postings, and my CO, who had worked in GHQ, knew people and knew who, we all knew who to go and see to get yourself posted back. Otherwise you would have gone to a rest camp or something, and you might have been sent anywhere. But the main thing was to get back to your own battalion again, which I did manage to get back, and we were then in
were you still
Benghazi. Oh no, I was then headquarter company commander then.
That's quite an important role, because you controlled the carriers and the mortar platoons and stuff like that.
Yes.
How did you see it, that responsibility?
Well, it seemed that my platoon commanders were capable of doing their job and training their people, which was essential. Fortunately, I was lucky in my platoon commanders,
Who were?
There were Philip Hampson, Rory O'Connor, and Cyril Catford. There were three who went right through the desert and through Normandy as well. So we all knew each other very well indeed, and we still do. We've still kept our friendship up. We still meet up every year.
What do you remember of the rest of the desert campaign? Any other stories or incidents you can recall?
Yes, I remember when we went back to when I got back to the battalion. We were on the outside of Benghazi on an escarpment, and it was just desert. Stones and sand and scrub. But in this, at this time of the year, this would be, I don't know, January, February time, I should think, or March. There was, every morning, there was a mass of mushrooms. And the troops used to be sent out to pick mushrooms, and they picked enough mushrooms to feed the whole battalion for breakfast every morning for a time. An incredible sight to see all these mushrooms growing in the desert, which we didn't know anything about at all. Because the desert can be an incredible place. It's in the springtime, it's a mass of wild flowers and colour, which is an extraordinary sight, but most impressive. However, this was a great variety. Instead of having tinned fish or something for breakfast, which was usually cold, and appalling tinned herrings or something for breakfast in tomato sauce, which was not very appetizing, but mushrooms really was incredible.
Anything else?
No, we were reasonably all right for water in those days. Going back to the desert and the Gazala in particular, we were on water from Tobruk, which was Tobruk Wells, which was very salty and saline. It was awful stuff to drink. But in the desert and in Libya, there were lots of wells there which were very good drinking water. It was a great thing if we captured a German water tanker, because they had sweet drinking water, which was very pleasant after that awful salty stuff from Tobruk.
Did you have any opinion of the Germans and the Italians as fighting men at that time?
The Italians were not rarely noticed as fighting men, because usually one, if you captured Italians, the officers in particular, they would be in their pyjamas in the middle of the desert, in the middle of a battle. They'd be getting into bed in their pyjamas, and several of them captured were all in their pyjamas. Well, the troops were in no such state, but they were very willing to come and join us and come to over. The Germans didn't have any high opinion at all. There was only one division of the Italians, which was a parachute, I believe it was. They were composed of parachutists, and they were in the southern part of the line, and they were not. That's next out there, isn't it? They were not shifted, and they held their position. It's the only, I think they were called the Fulgori Division. But they were parachutists, and they were a very different caliber from all the rest of the Italian army.
What about the Germans?
The Germans, of course, as usual, were first-class fighters and very difficult people to